Good afternoon. My name is Ann Cavall, and on behalf of the Breast Cancer Education Association Board of Volunteers, I welcome you to the BCEA webinar education series. I encourage you to grab a pen and paper, as there will be plenty of good information shared in the next hour. Today, we are pleased to offer the second session of a new series of webinars exploring the breast cancer experience in Minnesota communities with unequal cancer burdens. In each session of this series, we strive to help each community share its voice so that we all have a better understanding of the burdens of breast cancer in their community and the unique cultural features that may be barriers or help to support women in their journey. We are very grateful for the gracious contribution of Dr. Lonnie Neal for today's webinar. Please watch for future sessions of the Sharing Our Voices series coming later this year. Today we have participants joining us in two ways, via webcast or by phone. For those connected via webcast, please follow along with the slideshow on your screen. Also, for those, you can also submit questions during the Q&A portion near the end of the session. 2018 will again be a year that the BCA continues to expand our mission of providing breast cancer education resources. This year's educational programming will continue to encourage, engage, and empower those affected by breast cancer in a variety of ways, including webinars such as this one offered throughout the year. Also, through our signature education conference, which is scheduled for October 6, 2018, at the TIES Conference Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. This conference will deliver the most up-to-date information on breast cancer treatments and nutrition, a mobile mammography unit on-site, and many roundtable discussions that connect attendees on the most pressing breast health topics. Please mark your calendar for October 6th, and we hope to see you there. Please also tap into the ongoing resources on our website and social media channels available 24/7. If you were unable to attend any of our previous webinars, including the first session on this topic, recordings of these sessions are available on the BCEA website at www.breastcancereducation.org under the webinar tab. This is a great way to easily access valuable information at your convenience. The BCEA also welcomes your involvement in our organization. We welcome participation on all levels and have many different types of volunteer opportunities available, whether it is just for an hour a year or a couple hours a month. We have exciting plans for 2018 and hope that you can help us deliver education and empowerment to those fighting breast cancer. If you have not done so already, please connect with us on social media. We regularly share and foster discussion on the latest news and resources in breast cancer detection, diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship. We also encourage you to share what you learned today using the hashtag BCEAWebinar. Please also be sure to keep your eye out for more information on what we have planned for 2018, and we will share specific information as soon as details are available. And now I'd like to introduce the speaker for today's webinar, Dr. Lonnie Neal. Dr. Neal pursued her medical education in Wisconsin, completed her residency in internal medicine at the University of Minnesota Hospital, and chief residency at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. She has been at Mayo Clinic since 2000 as a member and consultant in the Division of General Internal Medicine. She sees patients in the Breast Diagnostic Clinic and the Mayo Outreach Breast Clinic, Good Samaritan. Her scholarship focus has been dedicated to the teaching and mentoring of medical students and residents about breast disease at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. She is also involved with incorporating new developments about breast cancer detection and prevention into the curriculum for clinical rotations at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and for the Mayo School of Continued Professional Development. Her interests include topics and research in breast diseases. Welcome, Dr. Neal.
Thank you, Anne, and I hope you can hear me well. I'm very happy to speak to you and your audience about a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and that is the racial survival disparities in breast cancer diagnosis and treatment. My objectives today are to review barriers that prevent us from getting treatment early, particularly in African American women. I want to discuss how an individualized approach to evaluate breast cancer risk can be of assistance in early diagnosis and treatment, and even breast cancer reduction. And then we'll review the role of breast imaging, what type of breast imaging might be good for you, and then again review minority participation in genetic evaluation and how genetic evaluation and risk assessments can hopefully reduce the risk of breast cancer in every population. There's a great article that was written by Dr. Bobby Daly and Dr. Olapati out of Chicago called A Perfect Storm. And in that review, they looked at the issues that are associated with the increased risk of more advanced and more serious types of breast cancer that occur in African American women. And you'll see that I've outlined a statement where it says African American women are less likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer than white women, but are more likely to die from breast cancer. And there are several factors that go into this. First, I want to talk about tumor biology. When we talk about tumors, I'm talking about any lump in the breast. Sometimes we call it a lump, sometimes we call it a tumor, sometimes we call it a nodule, but sometimes we biopsy these and we find cancer. In white women, we're more likely to notice tumors that are using estrogen or progesterone, normal hormones that occur in the body and are associated with lower grade tumors. In African American women, we're more likely to find tumors that are not using estrogen or progesterone to grow, and tumors that may not even be using another growth factor called HER2 to grow. We call these hormone receptor negative tumors or triple negative tumors, and we see that these types of tumors are of a higher grade. They tend to be more aggressive. So that's what tumor biology is. We're also interested in tumor genomics. What is it about the genes in our body, genes that we likely inherited from our ancestors, that put us at higher risk of developing breast cancer and other types of cancers. So in the African American community and certain white communities, we're likely to see BRCA gene mutations or variants of the BRCA gene that we're really not certain about when it comes to assessing risk of developing future breast cancer. We're more likely to have what we call poor prognosis somatic mutations. These are not genes we inherit at birth, but they may be mutations that occur in our non-sex cells, not in eggs or sperm, but they occur in other tissues of the body. And when we look at the breast, are we more likely as African American women to have mutations in our breast tissue that increase our risk of breast cancer or give us a poor outcome when we do get breast cancer? We're also perhaps more likely to have unfavorable epigenetic alterations. Epigenetic meaning that we may carry genes that put us at risk for breast cancer, but those genes may never be expressed, or they may be expressed may affect how our normal cells read the genetic material and what that outcome may be. Another thing which I think is likely most important are patterns of care. I think African-American women are more likely to ignore signs or symptoms, which may result in delays in treatment. We may not get screened as regularly. And once we are screened and diagnosed, there may be a delay in treatment. And we're going to review all of these patterns of care at the end of my talk. There may be misuse of treatment in that treatment may be not following the usual guidelines for breast cancer treatment, and there may be underuse of treatment if we can't get there for treatment. Are we missing episodes of chemotherapy? Do we run out of our medications and don't get them refilled? Or do we have side effects from either treatment that just prevent us from adhering to treatment? So we'll talk about this in a little bit. Another solution may be trying to come up with clinical trials. I think there are clinical trials that are available that could be helpful for women with these more aggressive types of breast cancer, but maybe we can't get there. Maybe our oncologist doesn't have access to these clinical trials. And how can we access that or have our community participate in trials that might be helpful? And then looking at treatments that don't necessarily fall into this one-size-fits-all type of treatment that may not work for the type of breast cancer you have, and we'll talk about that towards the end of my talk. So I want to focus on this People magazine issue, and on the cover you can see Angelina's double mastectomy, inside, her brave choice, and then next, this was the right thing to do. But I want you to keep in mind that for Angelina Jolie, who does carry a BRCA gene mutation, having a double mastectomy for her was the right thing to do because she has somewhere between a 60 to 80% chance of developing breast cancer in the future. But that risk, depending on our genetic makeup and age, may not be the right decision for everyone. And so you'll see this sign here. It says, one size does not necessarily fit all. And I want to go through how do we assess our risk of developing breast cancer. And once we know what our risk is, how do we change our behaviors, our screening patterns, and maybe even preventive therapy to decrease that risk? So we will be addressing people who are at average or moderate risk. Those are people who maybe need to change how they live their lives in terms of exercise and diet. How do they get screened? How do we look at genetic counseling? Maybe we need more enhanced screening. Maybe we need to be on medications to lower our risk for having breast cancer, or maybe we do need to have a preventive type of surgery to lower our risk. So step 1A is to look at your family and perhaps identify women with an inherited predisposition for breast cancer. So in your family, do you have many people who develop breast cancer at an early age? Do you have many people in your family who had early onset of ovarian, prostate, or pancreatic cancer? Do you have relatives who had breast cancer in the left breast and then a few years later developed ovarian cancer? Or another breast cancer but in the opposite breast? We also look at families of Ashkenazi Jewish inheritance and families where men had breast cancer. And we're very interested in talking to their immediate relatives, their mothers or daughters or children, to assess their risk and determine do we need to embark on some sort of screening program and lifestyle program to decrease their risk. Step 1B is who needs genetic counseling? And there's a very handy tool. You remember I mentioned yourself, mother, sister, daughter, and immediate relatives, immediate siblings or your mother's sister or mother, your father's sister or mother, your father's brother or your mother's brother. Did they have breast cancer? How old were they when they developed breast cancer? And do they carry some Jewish ancestry that may put them at risk? So there's a very helpful website highlighted here, breastcancergenescreen.org, where you can look at, get a copy of this worksheet. And if you check more than two items, talk to your primary care provider about whether you need to sit down and talk to a genetic counselor. When you do meet with a genetic counselor, what they're going to do is look at your family history to see if there's a hereditary cancer pattern. By that I mean, did you inherit a gene from your mother or father? You can't get it from your aunt, uncle, or grandparents, or your siblings, or your kids, but is there a hereditary breast cancer pattern that might be running in your family? And do we need to discuss having genetic testing that may look for BRCA genes, but now we know that we need to expand genetic testing because there are other genes that may be associated with a higher risk of breast cancer. Once we've talked about should you be tested, then the geneticists will discuss the risks and benefits of testing. Yes, genetic testing may just be a blood test, or they may collect cells from the inside of your mouth or inside your saliva, but there are risks and benefits with having the test and knowing the results. Some people might be too nervous to get checked. Other people may have a false sense of security when they get checked. Please remember that when you decide to have genetic counseling, only perhaps 5 to 10% of people carry a genetic mutation that we know how to test for. But there may be other mutations in the world that we don't know how to test for. How do we interpret the test results, and do we share the results with family members? And people are probably thinking, of course we share them. But there can be family members who don't want to know. And how do we deal with that? The geneticist also provides a lot of psychosocial support before and after testing to help you deal with the diagnosis or the finding and perhaps move forward to minimize your risk or assist with early detection. Step two, once you've identified women at increased risk, how do we modify those risk factors? Well, are the risk factors reproductive, hormonal, or lifestyle? And we're going to talk about each of these. Another thing that can be associated with prior breast cancer risk is the results of a biopsy, perhaps showing atypical hyperplasia or lobular carcinoma in situ. These are not cancers, but they are associated or can be associated in certain circumstances with an increased risk of developing breast cancer in the future. So remember I talked about reproductive risk factors and lifestyle risk factors. And lifestyle risk factors have to do with postmenopausal obesity or alcohol consumption. You can see in the middle of this chart that RR stands for relative risk. The older you get, the higher your risk goes up when it comes to developing breast cancer. That relative risk is greater than 10 for patients who are 60 or older. Family history is associated with a doubling of your relative risk. Atypical hyperplasia and lobular carcinoma in situ can quadruple or quintuple your risk of breast cancer. Breast density seen on mammogram can also increase your risk. The more exposure to estrogen you have, the greater your risk of breast cancer. So if you have menopause after the age of 54, or if you have early onset of your menstrual cycles, usually age 10 or less, that long period of estrogen exposure can increase your risk. Another thing that can increase your risk is not having children. Or having your children late. Pregnancy, and childbearing decrease your exposure to estrogen and can lower your risk of developing breast cancer. We do know that combined use of hormone therapy, so use of estrogen and progesterone together for more than 10 years, can add a little bit of risk as well. Another thing that we like to do is use risk assessment tools to help us know who would benefit from either prevention medication or more intense screening with the addition of breast MRI to annual screening mammogram.
So, Dr. Neal, can we go back to the last slide just for a minute? Because you identified a couple places where the GAL model and the IBIS model are, and then links to that. So who would you suggest goes to those sites, or how would they use them? Is that at the direction of a physician, or is that something that someone should go out and be looking at now? What do you recommend how you should use those?
I would, if you're 35 and older, the GAL model is a great tool to determine who should take medication to lower their risk of breast cancer. And that tool can certainly be used by anyone. It's a very short question and answer that helps us put you in a bucket in terms of whether or not you'd benefit from medication. Anyone can access either of these tools. I would use caution, and I have to say that I prefer to do them with the patient myself. You can certainly be seen by any nurse practitioner or physician in a good breast clinic. They'll be very familiar with these tools. And we will use them in patients, or they will incorporate information about your breast biopsies as well. So sometimes we'll use them for patients who not only have a family history, but also patients who may not have a family history, but have had a breast biopsy that shows any type of atypical lesion and how beneficial that atypical lesion or multiple biopsies can be in terms of taking medication to lower your risk. Yes, anyone can use them or access them. The IBIS model, or the Tyrer-Cuzick model, can also be accessed by anyone. They've now added breath density to this tool, where you can insert the degree of mammographic breath density. But I would say that's still under discussion and should be, you should talk to your physician or nurse practitioner about these tools and the results you see with the use of these tools. So I don't want to frighten people or take the use of these tools out of context when we're looking at the results. So I would exercise caution and talk to your doctor, and certain doctors may refer you to subspecialists in a breast clinic to put things into perspective when looking at the results.
Thank you for that clarification. I just wanted to make sure we were following your direction on that.
Okay, good. And we can go back and forth. And so stop me anytime, and if you see I'm flipping by things. So that's the summary of risk assessment. We look at identifiable risk factors to look for opportunities to determine whether we need to be referred to a genetic counselor, or can we undertake things, activities in our own lives to decrease our risk for developing breast cancer, improve screening, or take medications, or even go forward with surgery in order to reduce our risk after we've discussed the findings with a genetic counselor or a breast specialist. Now, this is a little bit hard to see, but I'm interested in the slide in the lower left-hand corner. In that slide, it looks at data dating back, I think, to 1973 up through 2012, where we've looked at women who've been diagnosed with breast cancer. And in the slide, we've separated African-American women, shown here in red, from white women, shown here in green, who live in the U.S. And you can see that over time, probably around 1980s, we started doing mammograms and picking up breast cancer early. So there's a big jump in the number of breast cancers that were detected. But over time, we also see that the incidence of breast cancer has increased. And now black women, shown here in that reddish-orange color, is catching up with white women, who seem to have a decrease in the incidence of breast cancer here in 2012. We're not sure what accounts for this. It may be that people are hearing us when we talk about lifestyle modification in the white community, but we really don't know why the incidence of breast cancer has dropped here. It may also be that in white women, we've been talking about these atypical lesions. I talked about I will talk about atypical findings on a breast biopsy, which was prompted by findings on screening mammograms. And so it may be that they're using prevention, either medication or surgery, to lower their risk of developing breast cancer. But as we move forward in my presentation, keep in mind this upward trend in African American women. And indeed, this is a global look at breast cancer, where you can see in certain countries, breast cancer is certainly on the rise. So let's first talk about lifestyle modification and risk reduction. And we don't know how to prevent cancer, but perhaps we can reduce a person's risk of cancer by changing some of the things that I want to talk about here. And you see a nice bowl of cereal with berries. You see someone practicing some, looks like yoga here. And indeed, the question arises, why is lifestyle so important? And it turns out that when we look at breast cancers, particularly in the white population, 75% of breast cancers are dependent on our female hormones, our sex hormones, which are estrogen and progesterone. In these types of breast cancers, anti-estrogen therapies are very effective, and lifestyle modifications have been shown to reduce the amount of what we call endogenous estrogen, particularly in women who've gone through menopause. I don't know about everyone else, but when I went through menopause, I gained a lot of weight, and it really was hard to get it off, but it is doable. And by doing so, I can reduce the amount of estrogen that's circulating in my body, which may contribute to my risk of breast cancer. We do know for 25% of breast cancers and maybe higher numbers in the African American population, these breast cancers are not using estrogen to stimulate growth of breast cancers. And in looking at things, we need to develop agents for hormone or hormone receptor negative breast cancer. So body weight and breast cancer, we know that women who are overweight or obese, this increases their breast cancer mortality, not only breast cancer, but breast, colon, and rectal cancer, uterine cancer, cervical cancer, and ovarian cancer. All of these cancers are increased when a person is overweight or obese. We're not sure of the mechanism of action in some of these cancers, but for breast and endometrial or uterine cancer, we do know that women make a small amount of male hormones, which can be converted to estrogen by fatty tissue, hormones we get from fatty tissue. We also know that some of the action associated with obesity can increase proliferation or growth of cancer cells. There's inflammatory processes that also weigh in that may change the behavior of cancer cells and stimulate their growth as well. So I don't know if I'm going to talk about it in the future during this talk, but obesity is fighting obesity is certainly one way of decreasing your breast cancer risk. So trying to get back to our normal height or normal weight is going to be very advantageous in decreasing our breast cancer risk. We currently recommend 40 to 45 minutes of exercise daily to at least 5 days a week to result in a 10% decreased risk of breast cancer in postmenopausal women, and they're saying a 4% decreased risk in premenopausal women as well. So these are well-studied results, and certainly something that a lot of our patients try to take to heart. Alcohol has also been associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. For some reason, and I don't know if it's due to weight gain, but alcohol can increase your blood levels of estrogen, and some of the breakdown products of alcohol can cause some DNA damage that may result in abnormal cell growth. So we currently recommend that women not ingest more than one alcoholic beverage today or per day, and we want to really explain when we talk about a serving of alcohol or a drink of alcohol, we try to keep it less than a half a bottle of beer, 4 ounces of wine, or a half a shot per day. It's been challenging for a lot of people. The other thing we can do to reduce your risk or prevent breast cancer, I'm going to say reduce your risk, is we do have medications for women who, using those risk estimation tools, have been shown to be at a higher risk of developing breast cancer. So for women who are premenopausal, they're still having menstrual cycles, we can recommend tamoxifen only. And then for women who are done, you know, a year out from their last menstrual cycle, we have several medications, including tamoxifen, and another class of medications, including exemestane and anastrozole, which, while not currently FDA approved for breast cancer risk reduction, can also reduce risk of breast cancer. I didn't mention raloxifene. It's a medication, a sister medication to tamoxifen, which we can use in postmenopausal women to reduce risk of breast cancer by 50% or sometimes higher, 60 to 70%.
So with chemo prevention, let's step back there. So in your practice for women receiving chemo prevention, what do you observe as the most likely side effect that would cause a woman to stop taking the prescribed chemo prevention medication?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Anna. I just happened to have a slide on that one. And you see this poor woman with a fan, and she looks a little sweaty. But hot flashes are probably the biggest reason that women stop the medications. And they can be hot flashes during the day or at night that disturb sleep. Also, when we go through side effects, another side effect can be vaginal dryness, which may interfere with intercourse and cause pain with intercourse. We talk about potential risks of using tamoxifen, which include a very, very rare risk of uterine cancer, a very rare risk of blood clots. And then the last two I mentioned, the aromatase inhibitors, exemestane and anastrozole, are sometimes associated with joint pain. And so when I sit down to talk to women about potential side effects of medications, of these medications, the biggest complaints women give me are the joint pain from the aromatase inhibitors and the hot flashes, which may be associated with those as well as tamoxifen. So those are the things I talk about. But I also try to focus on the benefits. We typically use these medications in women who have a 5-year breast cancer risk of greater than 3%. Certainly, we meet people with higher risks, people who have atypical findings on their pathology, and then it's really difficult to get people under the age of 50 to take these medications. We look at the IBIS model, the IBIS model, and calculate their risk. We do more frequent screening. Some of them, if they have genetic mutations and they're under the age of 50, they sometimes will proceed with preventive surgeries rather than take the medications, usually because we're not exactly certain that the medications in women who are BRCA carriers are very beneficial. Another thing I'd like to mention is a group of women with dense breast tissue. About half of women who are getting screening mammograms will have dense breast tissue, meaning that, let me move to another slide, or let me look in this slide. There's so much gland tissue in the breast that we can't see a cancer, in this case, hiding in the midst of that white gland tissue. Cancer and this dense gland tissue that's normal obscure each other. And so we're more likely to see that in younger women, so because they're of childbearing age, they're going to have a lot of gland tissue, whereas a lot of white in their breast tissue that you can see here. Whereas once you get to menopause and way after menopause, it doesn't show well on the slide, but there should be more fat tissue in the breast of women who've gone through menopause than in women who are premenopausal. So how can we get around that white, dense breast tissue that may obscure early detection of a breast cancer when it's really small? And we have three-dimensional mammograms, which are pretty easy to do and have been very helpful in picking up breast cancer early. Is what happens is that you get a three-dimensional picture. This is all the same breast, but the mammogram machine has taken several additional pictures, which the radiologist can filter through and perhaps in this first left-hand picture pick up an area of increased density, which they'll investigate additionally with either ultrasound or a biopsy. I'm going to go back two slides, Anne, and just remind people that screening mammograms in average-risk women should start at age 40. They can be done every year or every other year, depending on the society you're listening to. Is it the American Cancer Society, or is it the United States Preventive Services Task Force? You'll meet groups with different recommendations, but we like mammograms because they're easy, they're quick. We don't have to do a surgery to determine or put you to sleep. Some people wish we would put you to sleep for screening mammograms, but we don't have to do that, or we don't do that. But they're the best screening tool currently available. It has definitely been shown to be associated with a 15 to 25% decrease in death in women ages 40 to 49 who are getting screened by mammogram. We are limited, however, by the density of breast tissue. We do use radiation to do mammograms, but it's a very, very small amount. Sometimes we may see something and have a woman call back for additional pictures, which can be very much anxiety provoking. So those are the limitations of screening, but it is beneficial to catch, it's a good test to catch breast cancer early.
So as far as screening goes, are you seeing any improvement in the confusion over screening guidelines, and are women more likely to individualize an optimal screening schedule, or are they still not certain? And then also I'm just wondering about what, if you're seeing any improvement in screening in underserved populations.
In yes, there's still a little bit of confusion. You know, I was telling you that in women 40 to 49, some recommendations say start screening at age 50. And that can be, it can be an argument in average risk women as to whether or not to do that. And so what we hope happens is that women will sit down, talk to the healthcare provider about when they want to start. And personally, I still feel starting at age 40 would be a good thing to do, since it is associated with a decrease in death. I know there are women who start at age 50, but it's amazing that we do pick up probably, maybe 15% of breast cancers in women in that 40 to 50 age group. So I think starting at age 40 is very reasonable. It also, you know, when you start and how often you do it depends on what sort of outcome you're looking at. So if you're looking at death as an outcome, I think screening every other year is probably reasonable. But if you're looking at decreasing or catching breast cancer early and minimizing, you know, the use of chemotherapy because the cancer may have grown for a while, 2 years as opposed to 1 year, is also beneficial in my mind. I see, and I'd like to have people catch it early, have surgery, radiation, as opposed to catch it later when we may need to add a more extensive surgery and chemotherapy to the treatment. In terms of underserved populations, underserved minority populations who may not have access, this is an issue, and I think it's an issue that may be related to timing and work schedules and getting to where you need to get to have the test performed. And it's especially hard if you have, you know, you take a day off from work to get your screening mammogram, and then they may see something on the mammogram. They want you to come back a different day. But getting a day off from work to get back to the place to get additional mammograms or additional breast imaging done can also be hard on a person because you're missing work or trying to get a ride to the place where you need to have the test performed. So, yes, that is an issue. Did I answer your question, Anne?
Yes, thank you very much.
Great. I do want people to know that in addition to mammograms, there are other tests that are available that minimize that issue of background noise from increased breast density. There are tests like molecular breast imaging. You may hear it called gamma imaging at other institutions, where they do, with the help of a dye, they can do either using a different type of camera, a gamma camera. There are some types of mammograms that use a dye to detect breast cancer. These aren't early and eliminate some of the background noise. So those tests as well as breast MRI have increased sensitivity in terms of eliminating that background noise from breast density and picking up breast cancer early. So tip right now, when we talk about using breast MRI, it's a very expensive test, somewhere between $2,500 and $5,000, depending on where you go to get it done. We typically reserve that test for patients who have gene mutations that might increase their risk of breast cancer. Patients with gene mutations in a first-degree relative, history of radiation to the chest between the ages of 10 and 30, those women should get screening breast MRI annually. Or if we use the IBIS risk assessment and find that the lifetime risk is greater than 20% based on family history, those women are also currently eligible for screening breast MRI. So I want women to know that as well.
So can we go back to the those risk models? Are they...
Oh, sure.
The risk models that you talked about, in are,
yep.
are the they the GELMA. Same? Right. So is the risk predication accuracy the same for African-American women as compared to the accuracy of the in the majority population?
You know, that is a very good question, because while the GALE model identifies risk, I don't believe the IBIS model does identifies race. The I don't believe the GALE the IBIS model identifies patients by race.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah. So I think that's something that we're all working to rectify. And then, of course, the IBIS model is the only one. Well, there's another model called the Klaus model. But in looking at these are the two models that use family history to identify whether or not you would qualify for breast MRI. And then we talked about one size does not fit all. Angelina Jolie carries the BRCA gene mutation. And so for her, she felt that having her breast tissue removed was the best option for her to reduce her breast cancer risk. And indeed, having mastectomies or having your breast tissue removed will reduce your risk of breast cancer by 90 to 95%. And we have long discussions with patients about their risk, their genetic mutation or other associated risk factors that put them at high risk, which may prompt them to select surgery as an option for breast cancer risk reduction. So, as Anne mentioned, individualized risk assessment can help guide risk reduction strategies. We can do that risk assessment by collecting family history or referring to a genetic counselor in those patients who have a strong family history. And then for average risk women, perhaps lifestyle modification, preventive therapies in terms of medications or surgery may be the best approach. So it's all individualized when it comes to trying to make a decision as to what works best for you. Now, I'm going to go back to my slides from earlier, where we were talking about African-American women being less likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer than white women, but more likely to die from it. We had talked about tumor biology, tumor genomics, patterns of care, and those are the issues, but what are the solutions? We have looked at and continue to look at community efforts. So when you get treatment at your community hospital as opposed to an academic medical center, one attached to a university where they're doing a lot of research, you may not have participation in all the research that's going on in your in a smaller community hospital that you would in a bigger hospital where they're doing a lot of research. So that can be a barrier to participation that might be life-changing. How can we develop trials to look into social factors, meaning access, education, early screening, to improve early detection of cancers that might be life-threatening in our community? The other thing we're looking at is with these research models is looking at genetic sequencing studies to get a better idea of what is promoting rapid growth of these more aggressive tumors, unusual tumors that we don't see very much, very many of. How can we develop new interventions that would stop these tumors from growing and preventing patients from dying of these sometimes very rare tumors that you see in the patients who have breast cancer that's not using estrogen or progesterone to grow? What's making those tumors grow, and how can we stop that? We need, and I think we've done a fair job in improving insurance coverage and affordability of some medications, but we certainly can always improve on the cost of coverage of care. I think a lot of patients are afraid of what breast cancer means to them. How can we communicate with physicians in the community and enhance trust in the community and collaborate with academic and improve communication between academic health centers and communities in dealing with these cancers? So this is just, you know, the perfect storm that I was talking about. We see the storm clouds, and we see the umbrellas, and that's where we need to improve our access and education and understanding of a disease to decrease the impact on our communities. And I see we've got 2 minutes for questions. Sorry about that, but
that's okay. You had a lot to cover. So
yes,
you
were asking questions too. So that was helpful.
Yep. So we'll go back to the very beginning. We're curious about, is it known and projected what percentage of African American women may have the BRCA mutation?
We really don't know. Dr. Olapati, who wrote this particular article, is looking at, I guess I would call it geography, of how people travel from one continent to another. And once they get to different continents, how do they travel within that continent? And so a lot of African Americans came from the Gold Coast of Africa, where a lot of slave trade was. There are a lot of African Americans in part, or I should say African people in South America, where the slave ships would stop, in the West Indies, where the slave ships would stop, and how did that transfer of humans result in a spread of the BRCA gene? So she's doing a lot of research in that area, or other genes that are associated with breast cancer.
Very interesting. In the last minute, we want to go back to the perfect storm and then the umbrella. So can you speculate on the primary cause of underuse of treatment?
I think it's a community issue. I think there's a fear issue of, and there's an access issue. I'm going to narrow it down to those three, where people have trouble getting to screening mammograms for early detection. Once they find a breast cancer on self-exam, they may be afraid of what the treatment may entail. You know, mastectomy, chemotherapy, those are frightening words.
Well, gracious thanks to our speaker, Dr. Lonnie Neal, and to everybody for joining us today. Again, please share what you learned today via our social media channels, and we look forward to seeing you on the next webinar. Thank you very much.
Take care, everyone.